Well, Don Yoga, a lot of newspapers and magazines about 10 years ago were calling it a cult.
They had a vision, which is they were going to save the world by creating 100 million Don healers. He has a quota to meet. He's got to bring in 2 slaves a month. Before I'd left, the headmaster had said, focus on your vision. The whole time you're there, focus on your vision. I was deciding I was going to do something with my life. I was going to be a hospice. And then when I come back, he's like, did you get your vision? I was like, well, yes, I did. I want to work with dying people. And he was like, what? Dying people? They're already dying. They're done. You
come find your vision. And if it's not our vision, you made an error. I think Wim generally has good intentions, but I also think good intentions don't mean anything, right? Like,
yeah, and disagreements are one thing, but when people are fucking drowning and dying, that's when we get into a whole other area.
Don Yoga. Maybe you've never heard of it. Maybe you've, you know, when you were on college, you're at a college campus, you came down and saw like a free yoga center, a free lesson, and you tried it and it was awesome, but weird. Maybe your brain vibrated. Maybe they made your brain vibrate because that was like a key part of their method. Maybe if you went a little deeper, they asked you to sign up for ever more expensive courses. Well, Don Yoga is, well, a lot of newspapers and magazines about 10 years ago were calling it a cult. There were lawsuits, there were sexual abuse allegations because this Korean founder who has got quite a story of his own named Ichi Lee had, you know, realized that he was the center of the vibrating universe and that he could teach you the techniques to get to exactly where you needed to be, where your karma brought you. Of course, for every karmic lesson, it would put you further and ever deeper in debt. There was a direct relationship with the amount of money you earned and you gave to the organization and your spiritual enlightenment. Well, a few months ago, this guy named Chris Flanders reached out to me, a big fan of the podcast, and he said, look, you have to do something on Don Yoga. And, you know, personally, I am not an expert on it. And when you start digging into the records, and I've looked at some court cases, I've read some news articles, even the name Don Yoga is a bit of a mirage. Right now, it might also be called the Body and Brain Yoga and Tai Chi Centers, of which there are at least 4 in my home city of Denver, Colorado. It is a big thing. It is a mass movement. And I wanted to talk to Chris about it. So Chris, thank you so much for being here on the show. I really appreciate you reaching out and then, you know, wanting to tell your story.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, they were Don Yoga, and then they received a whole bunch of backlash in around 2010 in Rolling Stone and CNN and Forbes. And so they've since rebranded as Body and Brain Yoga, and they're still operating in, like you said, 4 around Denver. I believe there's 4 around here in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And they're still operating all over the world. And they went a little bit more underground, more covert, but they're still operating and still taking advantage of people.
Yeah, what's the draw of Don Yoga? You know, how did it get so big? Because it's not really, I mean, I wouldn't say this is like one of the marquee top known religious organizations out there. So what is it that brought you in and brings people in to make them love it so much?
Well, for me, I was a yoga practitioner, and I moved to a new neighborhood that was near the University of Washington, and I needed a new yoga studio because I'd just gotten into yoga. And I was walking along University Avenue, and I saw their center, and it said yoga, tai chi, meditation, all the buzzwords out front.
Yeah, all the classics. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's all in one. And then so I went in there. And it was like flypaper for people like me. And I was a naive little gnat at the time. And
22 years old, just out of college, like, you know, sort of the wide-eyed and ready to tackle and change the world for the better. I was
absolutely
there too.
And naive to the fact that in the spiritual world, there's traps. They're just lying in wait, people waiting for you to come in and give them your money and your power. and in our case, our youth, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that almost sounds as bad as grad school, because I went in grad school and they took my youth too. So what are they offering you? Like, you know, you know, from what I've read, it's not really Tai Chi in the way that Tai Chi is usually taught. It's not yoga in the normal way.
It's like a mashup. It was a mashup of a lot of things like Tao practices, Qigong, and yoga was not really anything to do with yoga as we know it with the Indian tradition, like down dog and sun salutations and stuff like that. It was more, it was sort of innocent and simple and childlike and actually pretty effective in what they were trying to do physically and mentally, because you know, in our society, there's a void, there's a spiritual void, there's a connection void. So they offer like this sort of vague spirituality and community. And plus they love bomb you the second you walk in there. And
everyone loves a good love bomb, right? You know, we all feel lonely and then we're told, hey, you're part of our community. Our community is awesome. And there's all these good looking people here that helps.
Yeah, there's a lot of young people. And as soon as I walked in there, there was an attractive young woman who greeted me, and she was very happy to see me. Her eyes lit up and she looked right at me and it was like, okay, you know. And she set me up with a meeting with the headmaster of that center. It wasn't like regular yoga where these are our classes and this is our schedule. They say first you have to have a consultation with the headmaster. And so that was like a couple days later. I go in there and I see the headmaster, and there's all this gravitas behind meeting up with him. You know, like I'm led to this back office where he's waiting in this sort of meditation room, and there's incense.
What's he wearing?
He was wearing the sort of an Asian style, almost Taekwondo looking uniform, but his was different from the other people that were working there. Like he had a higher status. And he gives you like an energy evaluation, and with my permission, he prodded around on my abdomen, and I would say like, oh, that hurts, you know, that's uncomfortable. And of course, oh, that's bad. It's really bad if that's uncomfortable. That means your energy is like that of an old man, and you're only 22. Geez, you need our help real bad. So I started with the classes right away.
Now, let's get back to this examination. Do you think there, you know, you were in the organization for a little while. Was there any method to his madness? Was he like, oh no, here is your, you know, aging pancreas or whatever? Or does he just make it up on the spot?
I think it's the same for everyone. And I later read more testimonies online. And then that's when stuff started to become more clear that they do this for everyone. Everyone comes in, they get the consultation, they get prodded and poked and informed that their energy body is in a very bad state, and they need this Dawn Yoga training immediately. And I'll add that I had had a close friend commit suicide just a week or two before I walked into this place.
And so you were looking for something, which is like how these organizations usually get you, right? Is that you're in a place where you're searching for answers. There's a trauma, and then, you know, you're on the down, and then you get the up.
Absolutely. And so they would do these energy healings on people, especially when you're new. They really put a lot of attention, you know, the love bombing. And so in one of the classes, I remember it was like, I think December 24th. So there was hardly anyone there. Everyone was gone for Christmas. And one of the volunteers, it wasn't a master, which is a master is what they called their teachers. And ironically, the masters were the most devoted slaves to the organization. And one of the people that was a healer, which is sort of like just under master, did a sort of a healing style, like almost Reiki or something on my chest. And I started weeping uncontrollably. And so I thought that there was something to this, you know?
Yeah. Why do you think that happened? Because, you know, one of the things that fascinates me about these sorts of religious movements, right? It's not just Dawn Yoga, it's tons of them, is that there is usually something there in the beginning, right? There's usually this thing where like, oh, you have an unusual experience. There's a meditation technique that is surprising and energizing. And then they, you know, essentially put an MLM structure on top of that.
Right. Right. So went in there and that happened. And I thought it was so, I was open to mystical experiences and I found it very mystical and just intriguing. And I wanted to do more. So I soon thereafter signed up for a year.
What does that mean? What's a year?
A calendar year. They, you know, most yoga places you pay by the month and you show up for the classes and that's that. But they had this other structure where they're like, okay, every month it's $200. But if you sign up for a year, it's only 170. And I think
that's typical.
I talked them down a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Up and down a little bit.
It's like a gym membership. And so far, gym membership doesn't sound so bad, right? You know, you get your yoga, you're getting your brain vibration, maybe some free energy healings. But things didn't stay at the level of a gym membership, right?
Not at all. I mean, within a month, I was invited to attend this retreat in Sedona. They have a major retreat center outside of Sedona, Arizona. And they told me I could go and it was expensive. But again, I talked them down and I could fly for cheap because my dad worked for the airlines. So I was able to get off work and I attended this retreat. And I thought it was like a really, like they had a vision, which is kind of a core tenet to the cult, was they had this vision that they were going to save the world. They were going to save humanity by creating 100 million Dawn healers. And
100 million Dawn healers.
Right. Around the world.
What was the mechanism that would work? So you'd save the world because you have enough people, and what would they do?
Well, they cited that sort of more recently debunked 100th monkey thing. I'm sure you've heard of that. Like once 100 monkeys.
Monkey? No, what's that?
It's like this thing I've seen brought up in other contexts, but they were saying like once 100 monkeys on an island, it's like a critical mass sort of principle that once 100 monkeys figure out how to use a tool, like monkeys on the other islands nearby, they figured out how to use the tool too without you know, even being informed. It's like a connected consciousness sort of thing. So their reasoning was if we had enough in the world, if we had enough healers in the world, it would create a critical mass and humanity would turn towards peace and away from violence and we would save the world. And at the time I was like, how awesome that someone has a vision and a practical vision. So I was on board with that. And then as time went on, they weren't happy with me just being a Dawn healer. They wanted me to become a Dawn master, which is a Dawn slave.
And how old are you at this point? You're still like 23-ish? Is it when you could have become the master?
Yeah, 22. I turned 23 probably early on.
Great.
And so as time went on, I actually joined the healer thing, which was another retreat. It was about $5,000. I was still, really enthusiastic at the time. So I was like, well, $5,000 is a lot, but you know, I'll put it on my credit card. I had a decent paying job, so I figured I'd pay it off over time. And the retreats in Sedona were fun because I meet all these people in this beautiful place and adventures and all sorts of energy exercises as a group. And
are you finding your friend group is migrating into the Dawn yoga circles?
Oh, quite the opposite. My friends, most of them were like, that seems really weird. Even my esoteric friends are kind of like, I don't know about that, man. But I met other people, like-minded people, and even, you know, budding romantic interests and stuff within the group. And everything was going well, but they just kept pushing me to do more and more, spend more and more time with them, estrange myself from my friends and my family. And they wanted me to become a master. I could eventually deduce that the headmaster, he has a quota to meet. He's got to bring in, like, you know, two slaves a month or whatever it was. I'm sure it was unattainable.
He didn't call them slaves, though. He called them healers or something.
Yeah, right? Masters. There's like become master. A Dawn master. But it's when you become a Dawn master, you leave your entire life behind. You join the organization. They almost always, if not 100% of the time, take that person and send them to the other side of the country, the other side of the world to get them away from their family, away from their support network. Mm-hmm. People are going to talk sense into them, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you have no money because you work for them from early in the morning till late at night. Your life mm-hmm. is dedicated to them. You live in a small apartment with other Dawn masters and, you know, but
it's
all
a job. It essentially becomes like a sales position more than anything else. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. You lead the classes and mm-hmm. you appear to be a smiley, happy, put together person and hopefully bring in more, you know.
Do they pay their Dawn masters or is it sort of a thing is like the money needs to appear from outside the organization?
No, they didn't pay them. That was part of the lawsuit was alleged slave labor that these people worked for them and never got paid anything. And in fact, one of their tactics was getting you in debt to them through all these levels. Like the healer thing was $5,000. And then they had some other level that was, $10,000. And we're talking 2003 money. It was a lot more expensive. Yeah.
And you're in your 20s and that is like insane money. Insane money.
Insane, but they, it's like, it's for your spiritual growth. What's more important than that?
Yeah, well, you go to a liberal arts college where they maybe have told you that you can't put a dollar value on a liberal arts education. I mean, we're trained to this in America already.
Absolutely. So they just kept pushing me. I remember after the one of the retreats, I was reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying at the time.
Sorgil Rinpoche. Oh my God. That book has played a major role in my life, believe it or not, because it's such magical thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was deciding I was going to do something with my life. I was going to be a hospice nurse.
Oh, great. Amazing.
And so I came back. I never actually ended up doing that, but I came back from the retreat. And before I'd left, the headmaster had said, you focus on your vision the whole time you're there, focus on your vision and come back with your vision crystal clear because time is running out. The world's dying. Humanity's time is limited. So get your vision. Of course you go there and they have their vision laid out, 100 million healers. So like, here's a vision for you. And then when I come back, he's like, did you get your vision? I was like, well, yes, I did. And he's like, okay, what is it? And I was like, I want to work with dying people. And he was like, what? No. Why? Come here. Why do you want to do that? What? Dying people? They're already dying. They're done. Why don't you want to work?
Wait. Come find your vision. And if it's not our vision, you made an error.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was setting off. The warning bulbs started to become more and more unignorable. And then at one point he said, did you read something on the internet? Cause I had questions about the organization. I was like, why is it like this? Why? Right. He told me at one point he hadn't spoken to his family in 5 years back in Korea. Of course, they sent him to the other side of the world, probably to get away from everything he knew in Korea. And he hadn't talked. And I said, why does
that's an important part of this. Actually, we haven't gone into that, but this is actually a Korean organization, right? This is the founder is Korean. There's sort of Korean themes and everything that they do. And is it also as large in Korea or does it live mostly in places like in the West?
I'm not sure at this point, but at the time it was huge in Korea. They were teaching it in schools. They were teaching it even to the Korean military, South Korean, of course. And I think since then, more controversy came out around it. And so they had to pull back in Korea. So I'm not sure how they're doing now, but at the time.
It's interesting. When you Google around on the organization, the leader, Ichi Lee, is that how it's pronounced? I've only seen
It's Ilchi Lee. Ilchi. And I that's not his real name. I believe it meant chosen one, something naturally. To that effect. Right. Yeah.
Right. The chosen one. So the chosen one was recently at risk of deportation out of New Zealand, according to the internet. They're also selling one of their old properties in upstate New York for just $27 million. So if you want to get in on that, you can. What were they doing to ground themselves? I mean, do they also have like a scientific arm? Because I've noticed that a lot of these organizations try to like validate themselves with science. They run sort of hokey, you know, experiments that show you with the truth of like an e-meter or something that this is real.
Yeah, they had, you know, just like sort of the vague connections to studies, you know, studies show this, scientists show this, and what do they call that? The appeal to authority, like this is all about Ilchi Li, and he's a best-selling author, mm-hmm. and he's regarded, they said he was recognized as an enlightened person by a panel of enlightened gurus.
Oh,
in India, you know, I'm not sure who was on this panel, but it was like swamis and, you know.
That's actually fascinating, because usually my feeling is that when you get a bunch of enlightened people in a room, they don't agree that they're all enlightened. They're all like, no, you're wrong about the true nature of reality. So they had a panel of, apparently.
I'm sure there was some money involved there to be recognized.
Oh, right. Like, so it's sort of the way that Steven Seagal is a reincarnation of the Tibetan Lama Gesar Ling.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, he paid his way into that.
Sure. Surely.
Interesting. So one thing that happened in, you know, so there's a great Rolling Stone article, which is actually really difficult to access online. You have to sort of sign up to various things. It's called The Yoga Cult, how a Korean guru has created a fanatical following on college campuses as part of the Moonies, part New Age boot camp and pure profit. And you were in the organization around this time, or had you left by then?
I was long gone by then.
Okay. So what the article states, and this is what's really interesting at reading about 10-year-old articles, is that you know how things turn out afterwards. And it seemed that there was a spate of lawsuits. And you knew some of the people who were involved in these lawsuits. What were they alleging at that time?
They were alleging the slave labor, mental coercion, and even sexual abuse. Under the
in what
the
way? So the slave labor, it's like slave labor, we're talking about unpaid, more or less sales jobs here as masters, right?
These people not just sales, but they ran the classes, they cleaned the centers, they did the clerical work, they did the opening and the closing of the centers, and all of that was unpaid. And I mean, I'm sure they would say, oh, but we paid for your rent or whatever, but it was going to be a studio apartment with bunk beds and, you know, maybe 8 to 10 other Don Masters in there.
Oh, man. And all of these Don Masters work at the same couple of centers in the town, I'm guessing.
They'll work in the area. So, you know, I'm sure there's something in Denver, as there is. I'm sure there's something near Seattle where they have everyone based out of, and then they go off to work all day.
Yeah, I sort of want to check one out. I mean, they're like they're only a few miles from my house. I should
go drop in
and say hello. So it also alleged, though, other than slave labor, there was a lot of financial coercion, and there's also sexual allegations. So can you tell me about those?
Well, the financial coercion it would probably be like the sign up for these programs that cost tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And then once I'm sure you sign a contract, and then they say, oh, well, you know, if you become a Don Master and sign a contract for that, we'll erase your debt with us.
Ah.
So you're in debt to them. And there's one easy way out is to just turn your life over to them. And anyone that's going to sign up for that is already vulnerable.
Right.
And off you go. And then the sexual thing. There was at least one female that was taken advantage of by the founder. And I didn't know her personally, but I did know other people that were there and knew her. We were all sort of in this little group together, and I bailed out, but a lot of them went to Korea for a 3-year program. They called it a program, but it was really to sequester them from everything they knew here and get them in Korea and get them to sign up for a lifelong thing, I'm sure.
The thing about these lawsuits now, and you know, they're available. You can sort of download these online. Yeah. Maybe if I remember, I will put a link to some of the lawsuits and some of these articles down in the description below. But the crazy thing is that like with many lawsuits, like you have two sides saying two different, totally different narratives, but these lawsuits were actually dropped about a year after they came out. Do you know anything about why, you know, they weren't able to prove these cases?
You know, I don't know anything about that. I assume, you know, you file something like that in the United States, this stuff happened in Korea, and then it's behind closed doors. So what can you really prove? And as far as like the coercion and the slave labor, it's kind of like, well, you signed up for all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I reckon it's pretty hard to prove. I'm not a lawyer, but.
It's interesting because a lot of these groups play this sort of shadow game between what is legal and what they can threaten you with, because obviously somebody who's at not getting paid, right, really doesn't have, has given all their money over to the group. They're now up against an adversary that has a ton of resources in theory, right? I assume, you know, if Ilchi Lee is flying around in his private jet and has a giant center in Sedona, he's got money, and there's an imbalance in power there. But it also is so interesting that after all of these allegations came out in 2010, there seems to have been like a complete rebranding of the organization. Like now, like you can't even like Google Dahn Yoga, that's Dahn Yoga, and nothing shows up. It's just nowhere, like nothing for 10 years.
They shifted strategies. They used to try to be really visible, like that center I went into near the university had these floor-to-ceiling windows, and you could see inside, and you could see the classes and the practices going on. And then after that, they changed their name to Body and Brain. They just completely erased the Dawn thing, and they became much more secretive. They would, you know, put drapes or cloud over the windows, and it's gone much more sort of covert because it's strange looking. So I think a lot of people go, what is this? You know, it doesn't look like a yoga class. You're in there doing strange poses, and you know, they just went more underground, and but they still have people coming in. And I've had people, every time I've done like a little podcast or something about this, I have people reach out and say like, oh, thank you for saying that, because I was on the fence about signing up for their expensive program. Or they say, my brother has been in for a year and we haven't spoken to him in 6 months. Can you help us, you know, contact him and talk some sense into him? And
yeah, because they want to isolate you from people who are rational, right? They want to isolate. I mean, it's not just this organization, right? But this is like a standard.
It's a blueprint, yeah.
You know, you join the group, you know, you wear the clothes, right? They have sort of these uniforms that they wear that set them apart, that you, at first you probably feel goofy in, and then you feel like, this is my identity.
Right.
And, you know, what would you say, how do you know, like it, what fascinates me about cults lately has been how you differentiate a cult from a successful growing business, right? Uh-huh. Because they sort of play this game, and they probably even envision themselves as a successful growing business with this great strategy to get, you know, cheap labor to, you know, pursue what they want to do. So how do we know, as somebody who was in one of these organizations and got like cold feet, what are the characteristics that somebody needs to look out for if they're getting pulled into a thing like this?
I think it's the seclusion. That's what ultimately drove me out of it, is they were, anytime I didn't come to a class or I didn't come to something, they were saying, oh, you shouldn't, like I couldn't make it to something because I was having dinner with my mom and my brother. Mm-hmm. And the headmaster told me that was my physical family, but this is my spiritual family. And this is more important because it's spiritual growth, and your family won't understand. They'll hold you back from your spiritual growth. And then other times I went, you know, on weekend trips with friends, and they would say, oh, that's not good. You know, those people don't understand. They're going to hold you back from your spiritual growth, and so on and so forth. And they were just really pushy and judgmental. And it's a top-down organizational thing. They were being pressured mm-hmm. from their superiors to bring in more masters, bring in more healers, more money, more mm-hmm. devotees. And that didn't work on me. I think other people it worked on, this high pressure sort of thing, but that's ultimately where I left.
Now, another thing that you know, so when you read this, and I'll read you a sentence or two from the Rolling Stone article, because I think this is actually sort of interesting. If you looked at it from a certain perspective, the exercises that Amy Shipley did in Dawn Yoga were perfectly normal. Take what she was doing right now. So this is describing her at a retreat. Mm-hmm. It was near midnight. Amy and seven other devotees at Dawn Yoga, nearly all in their 20s, clad in blue tracksuits and barely functioning on 3 hours of sleep, were standing in a waist-deep fountain in the desert of Sedona, Arizona. On okay. command from their Korean trainer, all eight would plunge their heads underwater and hold their breath until their lungs strained. Finally rocketing to the surface, gasping and shouting a devotional song to their grand master, a middle-aged mm-hmm. Korean man named Ilchi Lee, weeping there in order to prove their sincerity. Now, is this sort of a typical thing that might happen in these organizations?
No, that sounds like master training. You know, at the level I was at, like the healer training, they were still very accommodating. They gave you, you know, like 8 or 10 hours to sleep, but no one ended up sleeping that whole time. You're too busy talking with other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was fun. So we never got a whole lot of sleep out there, and they fed us well. It was vegetarian food for the most part, but it was sort of like, you know, buffet style cafeteria. Mm-hmm. But from what I've read, once you get into those deeper levels, like now I'm going to be a master, then they know that they've got you. And then that's when they start doing the more intense devotional exercises. And I'm sure you read in that article, they outlined that woman who died.
Yes, someone died in Sedona, Arizona of dehydration on a sort of a grueling hike, it sounded
yeah.
like.
Yeah, it sounds like they were putting them through some sort of like, you know, hike, and they had a backpack full of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. she died of exposure, of heat exposure, exhaustion.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So in the beginning of these of entering this organization, you are love bombed. And love bombing, for anyone who's yeah. you know, new to this world, is like people tell you how great you are. They just feel they smile at you. They yeah, hug hugging. You.
Yeah, touch, connection, yeah. love, all this stuff that we lack in our society. Deeper meaning, you know, mm-hmm. beyond just material and consumerism. So that's really what a lot of us were after. We were after something mm-hmm. deeper. You know, you're coming out of school and it's just like, okay, find a job and do that until you die, like a battery.
Yeah, sounds terrible. Yeah.
And then so this was something, not just connection and community and love, but save the world.
Yeah, which is what we all want to do, because we all realize the world, and like every human in the history of the world realizes the world is coming to an end in very short order, whether you're right. a medieval Christian, an old timey yeah. Buddhist, or a modern climate activist. We are on the precipice of destruction. And yeah. And it certainly fits in with the ideas that we are playing with in the yeah. world. And so the love bombing happens, and it's sensual, meaning that your senses are lit on fire. And yeah. then you have this next level of training, which is, you know, they're still reeling you in. It sounds like it's still positive. It's yeah. bonding, and, but you're working a little harder for it.
At a certain point, it's the sunken cost fallacy. You've gone mm-hmm. this far. You've estranged yourself from your family and your friends. To bail out at that point would be humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
And plus you've got all this debt. I'm sure that you're not relieved of the debt until you complete, you know, the training. And mm-hmm. and I'm sure they're very crafty. I'm sure that they made sure that they hemmed you in to mm-hmm. the organization until it happened.
And then, you know, the really interesting thing is, so if you read the book, The Guru Papers by Diana Allstedt and Joel Kramer, which is really about, it's sort of like the workbook on cult functioning, the switch over into master training is truly fascinating, because you go from the most positive, you know, you enter the organization, everyone loves you and hugs you, blah, blah, blah. Then we have this sort of intermediary stage where you're having, you know, you're going on nice luxury retreats and you're eating good food, but it's probably not as intense as in that first few moments. And and then you're told to get to the next level, you have to embrace negativity. You have to say it's the tantric flip too. This is what they do in tantra as well, is that they say negative experiences are really positive experiences. And if you're able to make that mental switch, then you will have the keys to some sort of true universal understanding. And it's not unlike even what I write about in The Wedge, right? Because there's actually good things to being able to do some of this. But when it comes into coercion and they use that in a, you know, I mean, and there are also negative wedges, you know, in my book, The Wedge, I talk about like anorexia being a lot like this, right? With anorexia, you realize that food, like that sensation of hunger is actually a good thing for you. And then you have this negative outcome of, you know, malnutrition. So that's a negative wedge. Whereas a positive wedge might be, I can handle this cold water or this, this hardcore exercise, and that's actually making me stronger. But what they're doing here in that master training is creating a specific emotional connections to the organization, to the master, plus physical things. You know, they talk about hitting themselves in the stomach and saying I'm a retard or something, or maybe it's I'm stupid. And then from that, the image of I am going to save the world with this, it's very much like medieval penitent monks, right? Whipping themselves, or a muharram in Islam, where you're whipping yourself with razor blades in order to show your devotion to something greater. But it's what it's really doing as a social function is making you more a part of the organization that they've created. And now a word from our sponsors, by which I mean you. Thank you for being here. And I wanted to say, if you really like the stuff that I do, it would be great if you could support the show on Patreon, where you'll get early access to new videos and a lively community talking about, well, the weird things that I talk about on this channel. It would mean a lot for me if you could check out the link down below. And, you know, see if this is right for you. But if it doesn't, you know what really also helps me? If you like and subscribe and hit that bell icon, the algorithm really, really cares. And it gives a massive boost to let my channel spread all over the internet. And without further ado, back to the video.
You know, I'm a cold water bather as well. I have an ice bath set up at home. I got into Wim and the practice about 5 years ago, and once I saw him on Joe Rogan, and it was really super beneficial for me. It pretty much cured this chronic headache problem I'd had.
Hell yeah, that's great.
And one thing I loved about Wim when I first saw him on that show was Joe said, you know, you want something to drink, man? Do you want a beer? And he was like, hell yeah, man, I'll have a beer with Joe Rogan. And I was like, wow, this guy is awesome. He's not coming off as some guru wannabe fucking schlocky dude. He seemed like a real guy that had just, you know, had this exuberance. And like, I wanted to be that vibrant and that kick ass when I was in my late 50s or however old he was at the time. And I've seen it sort of go off the rails and then him be deified. And so when I found your work, I was like, yes, finally someone is talking about this, and someone that was close to the organization.
Yeah, it's great. That has certainly been a fascinating thing in my own career. I wasn't planning to talk about Wim, audience, just so you know. I've been trying to get off of talking about Wim lately.
I understand. But yeah, that's what brought me to your channel in the first place. So
but since we're here and we're talking about it, I'll say, like, it's really fascinating to see somebody going from the very beginnings of that religious movement. I mean, there's like a dozen people or whatever who were doing this at the time when I showed up to millions and millions of people. And I think that Wim had generally, I think Wim generally has good intentions, but I also think good intentions don't mean anything, right? Like, you know, Ilchi Lee has a good intention to save the world doesn't mean that's what he's doing.
Yeah, and disagreements are one thing, but when people are fucking drowning mm-hmm. and dying, that's when we get into a whole other area. And the organization was just denying and just, you know, fix it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're listening. Fucking fix it, man.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to say about that. I will say that if you do a deeper dive into Wim's biography and inconsistent statements, there's a lot that doesn't add up. Things that even I thought were very secure of my understanding of Wim's past have gotten very squishy in the last few months. When you just start scratching at people's stories, because you need to create a myth. Like there's a necessity to create the myth. And if someone presents themselves, I mean, you can create a guru figure out of a lot of different ways, right? You can start with a broken figure. I was at rock bottom, and then I figured out this method to get better. That's sort of like Wim's story. He was a homeless guy, you know, $7 an hour, whatever, and broken, and then became great. Or you could be like, I am a great businessman and I'm so good all the time, and you should follow my message too. But the thing is you want to strengthen the myth that you create, and you want to reinforce it. And when you and because we're all human, all of us are stuck with our own idiosyncrasies, the lies start compounding and compounding and compounding. And then the lies, it becomes, you know, the neuroscience of lying is fascinating. I have this podcast out that, when we're recording, it's not out yet, but by the time you listeners listen to this, it will be out. But the neuroscience of lying means, like, once you lie a little bit, it becomes easier to tell the next lie and the next lie, and the dopamine neurotransmitter thing becomes easier and easier until lying is preferable to the truth. And I think I saw an element of that happened with Wim and the people around him. And it's reinforced with money, which is also what happened with Don Yoga, where you see, the thing about the Rolling Stone article, which was so interesting to me, is it almost equated spiritual progress with the amount of money you were able to raise for the organization. It's like, if you're making 20 grand a month for the organization, you're 20 grand closer to whatever that state is that they're
you'll see that with Scientology and another group that's come back into the news recently, a group I'm very well acquainted with over the last 20 years here in Seattle, the Modern Mystery School.
Have you heard of this? Who are they?
Oh man, it's bad. And they came back into the news recently because Miley Cyrus apparently has joined or is somehow connected to them. It's just an esoteric school, and early on in my spiritual,
is it related to the Greek mysteries? Is it that sort of idea of you take a sort of essentially a psychedelic substance at the Apollo Temple? Is Apollo somewhere in Greece?
I'm not super familiar with what they do, but they were very embedded with like Egyptian mythology.
Okay,
and some great people I've known for 20 years have been heavily involved with it for a long time. And it's always money. It's always more money. You have to pay this much. And they call it an energy exchange. You have to pay $777 and 77 cents, some very specific money they said is a numerologically aligned amount of energy exchange for you to get this next level.
Is that inflation proof? Does it change if the inflation goes up by 10%?
I'm sure at this point it's thousands. I'm sure they don't even deal in the hundreds anymore. So I'm more familiar with what they were doing 20 years ago. But in a nutshell, that's why I wanted to come on. And anytime I do an interview like this, I want people to be aware of the predatory practices that are out there for spiritual seekers.
Yeah.
Because they're traps lying in wait to take your money, take your power, take your time, take you away from your family and your friends, and be a battery to this succubus, basically.
Yeah. And is this something that you do? Like you said that when you go on shows, people will come to you and say, exit me. Is this sort of a thing that you're dabbling in as well?
Not exactly, but it makes it rewarding. It's the only reason I would do it. it all started with, I've been fascinated with cults and all levels of mind control, even scams and sales tactics and whatnot, since all that went down for me. And so I was on the Reddit community for cults, and I just typed up a couple paragraphs. This was my experience. I went to a yoga class, and that's all I was expecting, was a dang yoga studio. And next thing I know, I'm neck deep in a cult, an international cult of mind control and, you know, this whole organization. And then, so I wrote that up, and then I was contacted by a podcast. I did that one. It led to a few people reaching out to me and thanking me for illuminating them, because they were about to get involved. And then, which led to that Guardian article. I was in the Guardian.
Yeah, the Guardian article is fascinating. And the reason it's fascinating to me, because I read it recently, was that they don't even mention the name of the organization.
Yeah, that whole thing, that whole experience really pissed me off. Is at first I was like, wow, the Guardian? I'm going to be in the Guardian. Wow, that's neat. And then once we had loads of conversations with the journalist, we probably exchanged 50 emails. I figured filled out questionnaires that were 100 questions long, and they verified what they could. I had to send them whatever I could to verify my story, like pictures. And I dug up all sorts of stuff out of my archive to send them. And then when the article comes out, it's written as if I'm saying it, but I didn't type any of that up. It was through the journalist.
Yeah.
And it was just so misquoted and weird. And it just seemed like pure laziness and poorly written, I might add. And then they don't even name the organization. So yeah.
That was the weirdest thing to me. I mean, the journalist process has been changing a lot in the last few years. So it doesn't shock me that, you know, it could have been that their legal team got scared of getting sued. And I've noticed this a lot with organizations recently. Journalist institutions used to have balls, and they had balls when they were making a ton of money. And now that they're not making as much money, their risk, their ability and desire to take risks is much, much less. And that could have been what happened with that article. But I will say that a lot of things can go wonky when you're dealing with a current news organization, because they're all dying. All the news organizations, Guardian, you know, maybe the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post will survive, but like most of these guys are falling to pieces. Guardian, you know, Guardian has a better reputation than many others. But I have a question for you. How do we separate the idea of cult and the cult marketing idea, right? It almost sounds like it's like a sales funnel. You hook them with one thing, and then we constantly narrow them down until we titrate out the whales. Like that's like constant marketing speak. And when I look at like almost everything in marketing, it's not so dissimilar from a cult. They want Facebook to you to identify your selfness with Facebook, your selfness with YouTube or Instagram or the brand. Right. But those are companies, right? And they're making you work for free, right? I'm swiping for free on Instagram. Uh-huh. And how do we make a, you know, wait, is there a distinction between those two? And if there is, how do we identify what that is?
Well, anything that tries to separate you from your life and from your support network is what I consider a cult. So if Facebook or Instagram and YouTube, wherever, is trying to separate you from the rest of your life, it's dangerous. It's going to separate you from your connection to what is real. And these things can be tools, and, you know, a tool can save your life or it can kill you.
Yeah.
So ultimately it's up to us to maintain our connection with what is natural, what is pure, what is true. And there's always going to be people that fall for it. There's going to be people that are vulnerable or they don't have a connection. I think that's what keeps a lot of people in, is they didn't like themselves before they got in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So getting out means they have to go back to who they were.
Right. Go back to who they were with the stain of having been in a cult.
Right. So right. I'll just say to anyone out there that feels that they're neck deep or deeper, that you can redefine yourself. You don't have to go back to who you were. You don't have to belong to a cult. You can still maintain connection with your family, even if you're in and you stay in. You don't have to be an automaton or a robot for these people, these organizations.
Well, thank you so much for being here on the show. I really appreciate your, sharing your experience, because I think a lot of people can relate, and I think these things take a lot of different forms. If you happen to be in, what are they called now? We said,
body and brain,
body and brain, yoga and Tai Chi, maybe think, I don't need to spend $20,000 on this next course. You can find a cult that are cheaper cults. Right.
go do some Tao practices. You don't have to pay, tens of thousands of dollars to learn Qigong and so on and so forth. Just like you don't have to pay whatever they're charging for Wim's home, the video course or whatever, mm-hmm. was like $500 or something. Last I looked, and I looked into it, I was like, I'm glad I didn't pay for that, because I don't need to pay Wim $500 to show me how to do a headstand.
You know, the thing that I think got me with where Wim is now and where a lot of these people are is they start bragging about how much money they make. And one of the things that what's the other yoga cult that was Southern California? Is it Deepak? Yes, Deepak's yoga, the hot yoga, right? Bikram. So many people. Bikram yoga, he would brag saying like, women will pay me $40,000 for my sperm. That's one of his quotes, uh-huh. right? And then you have, Ilchi Lee talking about how much he gets paid to go speak to you, or as a validation. And now Wim is talking about for $50,000 for 1 hour, that's what people pay me to talk. And it's this interesting thing when they start validating themselves through dollar amounts and bragging about it, that the money is wagging the dog. Right. And the other thing is they all have free offerings. Like there's always this free service that you get in to get into the funnel. And then it can get wonky. Anyway, appreciate everyone being here. Share this episode with somebody who you think might need to hear it. And from Scott Carney Investigates, Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, namaste.
Namaste indeed.